You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. I'm recording this a few days after we lost one of the true masters of horror. Stuart Gordon was one of a kind, a brilliant provocateur who began his life creating experiences on the theatrical stage, shows that brought him great acclaim, as well as a stint in jail for breaking taboos. Stuart never lost his taste for upending the staid and the stately. Beginning his career with The Extraordinary Reanimator, his work was filled with black humor, rivers of blood, and twinklings of satire at a deep, dark human sensibility. It was such an honor to work with him on his two spectacular masters of horror films, Lovecraft's Dreams in the Witch House and Poe's The Black Cat. He was an artist and a craftsman and a wonderful man, and anyone who knew him or his work misses him terribly. There have been so many losses of the artist who helped craft the world of cinematic horror, enjoying its height of popularity now. Aside from their dark imaginations, the masters and mistresses of horror share many unexpected values: a great sense of humor, a concern for their society, and a sweetness and humility that surprises anyone who doesn't know any better. So many people expect those who induce terror, who wallow in blood and body parts, who explore the depths of our darkest emotions, to be dark of heart and spirit themselves, when nothing could be further from the truth. So I'd just like to take this moment to salute those we've lost in recent years to their art and their hearts. Stuart Gordon, Larry Cohen, George Romero, Wes Craven, and all who've left us way too soon, we love you and miss you and owe you a tremendous debt. Thank you. Our guest today has taken his love for the genre to outrageous heights. As a comedian, an actor, a podcaster, and as a writer, Jonah Ray is a man of many talents. And as the ringleader on the reconstituted Mystery Science Theater 3000, his affectionate embrace of the lower rungs of the genre library makes for a delicious feast of laughter, especially for those of us who know and love the movies that are not exactly masterpieces. We'll meet Jonah and share our love for movies, monsters, and mayhem after this. Obviously, this was recorded before our extended and unexpected hiatus, but we still feel the sorrow for the loss of the beloved artists who expanded and illuminated our genre. Stuart, Toby, Wes, George, Larry, and so many more of the trailblazers of horror will live forever in our dark little hearts. Since Postmortem has returned, our guest on this episode, Jonah Ray, has just launched a new podcast called Let Me Watch Your Movie With You, where he has guests run a live commentary on one of their films with him. I am humbled and flattered to have been his first guest on the show as we talk Critters 2 for 90 minutes. I hope you will check it out, and it pleases me that our talk with him and his with me dropped in the same week. So let's get on with it. Ladies and gentlemen, Jonah Ray. So Jonah, you are probably the first guest we've ever had who hails from Hawaii.
Yeah. You know, I'm always looking for more people in showbiz that are from Hawaii, but so far it's just me, Tia Carrera, and The Rock.
Well, that's good company.
Yeah, yeah.
So where did your love for the outre begin? I mean, were your parents movie fans? Were you a TV kid? What was the beginnings of it?
My earliest memory is probably my cousin Kalani visiting, and he brought you know, that suitcase VHS player that you could rent from a video store. Yeah. He brought that, and he brought Nightmare on Elm Street, and I was probably about four or so or five, and that kind of made a very distinct impression on me and my brother, and then that just kind of went from there. Me and my brother kind of became obsessed with horror at that point.
I guess that's called great parenting.
Yeah. My parents were very, you know, the only thing I remember them telling us not to watch when we were growing up was we were watching crazy horror movies, and but they didn't want us watching Eddie Murphy Raw. For some reason, it's very American, I think, in that way, where it's like the language was worse than the imagery.
And yet I bet that was as big an influence as the movies you were watching otherwise, because, I mean, your career in stand-up is your primary field, right?
Yeah, that's how I got started in, you know, the entertainment industry. Grew up playing in punk bands and, you know, and making little videos with my friends. But really, the stand-up was the only something. I loved comedy so much, but stand-up was the only thing I could figure out on how to get into showbiz. Like, it felt like it was this big dome in the middle of Southern California, and the only entrance that I was able to find where someone would just kind of not check my badge and see if I was really able to be in showbiz was like going through the open mic door. And yeah.
Where talent wasn't an issue, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, but it's interesting that you started not just in a rock band, but punk bands, because it's so anti-establishment, like horror films are, the genre films. And so was the appeal kind of the same thing, but in two different fields?
You know, I think it was just, it felt like stuff for outcasts. Even though my family's been in Hawaii a very long time, generations, I think I'm fifth generation born in Hawaii on my dad's side. But yeah, they came in early to work on, you know, sugarcane plantations and, you know, pineapple plantations and whatnot. And my mom, you know, moved there when she was a kid from California. So I got her, you know, pale skin. So I was already kind of this ostracized kid, and I had glasses and I was taller than everybody. I was a big kid. And it really was that the punk community in Hawaii was very small, but all the weirdos were welcome. and the same thing where every time I would go to, you know, see a horror movie or talk about horror movies with someone that was at a video store, they were accepting of me, which is very, you know, very true about, I think, the horror community. It's very welcoming.
It's true. What else? I mean, what drew you to the music first? Was that the thing you first thought was going to be your vehicle?
You know, I did think that, I don't know what I thought. I think it just like, I liked making stuff with friends and I liked having projects, and I really loved, you know, Metallica and then Nirvana. And then of course, Nirvana was the gateway for a lot of punk, and so was Metallica. You know, Metallica is how I found out about the Misfits, and the Misfits had all that horror iconography with their albums and you know, movies about or songs about horror movies, and you know, it all kind of careened into each other a lot for me. And I think I just did it because that was something to do that was creative and it was also social.
Well, you know, punk again is like sticking your finger in the eye of society, as is the horror realm. And, you know, it's busting taboos like we talked about with Stuart Gordon. This is a guy who embraced it all the way until he passed away at 72. He was a punk horror filmmaker. And the two really seem to cross paths. And you, not just in punk music, but your embrace of the genre films, but also in your stand-up, there's a lot of taboo breaking that goes hand in hand there.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I've never been an antagonistic guy. I've never, I'm, you know, 6'4". I'm a big guy. And with that, there's kind of you have to kind of be extra nice, I feel, you know, because a lot of people can, you got to basically show up and be like, I'm not going to, you know, eat your village. You know, there's a lot of, at least that's how I've always felt with being a larger guy. And so, I love that the freedom and the aggression that was allowed through the art of punk and horror and stuff like that. It's like you can cosplay these violent or aggressive emotions that I don't normally get to have. And for me, like the horror, you know, genre and punk very much are DIY. And though it's like, you know, I was never too anti-establishment, but I really always fell in love with the DIY aesthetic of horror and punk. It's like no one's going to give it to us. We just have to make this ourselves.
Well, it's surprising how many filmmakers were also in bands. I was, William Malone, John Carpenter, Tom McLaughlin, so many people who were in bands. And now, you know, John is more rock star than filmmaker these days.
Yeah.
And it's fun to watch that. So that correlation just seems fascinating to me. But comedy is something on top of that that seems to be unique to your career.
Yeah, you know, I grew up, I was born in 1982, so I got just, you know, comedy in my horror was the norm or the movies I watched growing up. You know, to Tales from the Crypt, what I was obsessed with, Return of the Living Dead, you know, Freddy got really fun. Right when I was kind of, you know, going to see Nightmare on Elm Street movies, Freddy got really funny.
Yeah.
And so these, it all kind of felt one and the same. It's, you know, a lot of that stuff. I just, and for me, you know, movie making just seems so big, and I never knew that I was allowed to be a part of it. And I always wanted to be a part of it, but I feel, you know, when I moved to LA, like I said, if I found like a scene, I'm so jealous of that group of guys of, Joe Bagos, Josh Ethier, and Graham Skipper. You know, they all moved out here, and now they're all making movies together. And I was like, well, I wish I had those friends when I moved out here. But I was by myself, so I just started doing stand-up because it was one of my interests.
Yeah, when you were a kid, did you go to the movies by yourself, or did you have compadres who shared your interests?
I had some friends that liked the movies I liked, you know, but – you know, I wanted to see movies so much, and I wanted to see every movie. I remember there was one day that both of my friends, I think, were either busy or on a vacation or something like that. And so I went.
Both of your friends.
Yeah. at the time, you know, and then so I went to, I had my dad drop me off at the theater, and, you know, I was under, you know, I wasn't old enough to go see a rated R movie. So he, you know, bought my ticket for Tales from the Hood. And then
cool I watched it.
Yeah, he was fine. He loved it. When he could, he would go and see movies with me, which is something that was very, very fun and great of him, because he never said, oh, let's watch this movie. He just let me pick and went with me. And I remember
it's
I got
that,
out.
Of Hawaiian thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's like he's like, you know, my parents, they just very much, they're like, you know, because they were kind of hippie drug people, so they kind of they didn't want to put any rules on me, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember I got out of Tales from the Hood, and I was just like, it was still the middle of the day in the summer, and I was just, I don't know what else I'm going to do. And then I just went back in and bought a ticket for Casper, the movie, and I just watched that. And that was my double feature that day. It was Tales from the Hood and Casper.
I remember when I was a kid, I went to the local movie theater and The Birds was playing. And as I was walking home from The Birds through a field, there was a big tree with no leaves on it. It was the autumn. And suddenly, two birds landed, three more birds landed, five more birds landed, and I hauled ass home. That was that was definitely an impressionable moment for me.
Yeah, I think I was, you know, I was really into, I had a lot of puppets, and I had a couple dummies. I had a Charlie McCarthy dummy.
Me too. I had a Jerry Mahoney.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Nice. I had a Charlie McCarthy and a Groucho Marx dummies.
Wow.
My Groucho one was nicer because it had the swivel head.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Sewed into place. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I remember I had just watched Child's Play 2, and I had my, you know, my dummies up on a shelf. And underneath the shelf was a chair, and I had this little novelty bat I got at a Giants game from a trip to San Francisco once. And, I woke up early one morning and it was still dark out, and I looked and my Charlie McCarthy dummy had fallen off the shelf, and somehow its upper body was like on top of the seat of the chair, and its legs almost perfectly hitting the ground, and its hand was on top of the bat. The novelty bat.
Oh, are you sure no one placed it that way?
Yeah, that's the thing. I didn't even think about it till recently that My brother knew how scared I was. I loved horror movies because I love being scared. But I should actually ask him about that, because he said, I don't know what you're talking about. That's creepy, man. So maybe he did. Because he also used to yell Candyman 5 times and lock me in the bathroom.
Oh, perfect. Now that's a good thing. So was he a fan also, or was he into other stuff?
No, he, you know, that's the kind of like such a defining thing in my childhood, is that him and our friend Donald, we loved, you know, metal and hard music, and we would play, you know, Metallica songs and Slayer and Sepultura songs in our garage. And then we'd watch horror movies. You know, Donald would come over on Saturday nights so he could watch Tales from the Crypt, because his parents didn't want him watching it. And my brother would just devour, you know, Stephen King books and Dean Koontz books, and just would read a bunch. But he was 3 years older than Donald and I. And he, at a certain point, you know, kind of wanted to be cool. He's, you know, and start going surfing more, going hanging out, smoking pot with the kind of more bro-ier guys, and kind of left me and Donald to, you know, we felt betrayed. We're like, no, those guys suck. Like, we're doing the cool stuff. And, you know, they just would play reggae in the garage. We're like, no, you're just like a guy in Hawaii. This is not what we do. And that actually, that anger and that desertion actually really did push me into finding even, you know, crazier sounding music like punk or and hardcore and crazier like movies that he wouldn't want to, like, you know, I was just like, it made me go full force into that stuff.
What was the biggest music performance you did?
Back in Hawaii?
Well, anywhere. I mean, I know anywhere. you put out your own, you have your own record label, you put out your comedy on that, but what was the biggest venue you did, biggest crowd maybe?
Oh, geez, I don't know. Probably the biggest crowd of any band I had was probably about, you know, 60 people, like, but shoved shoved into a room that only held 40.
Welcome to the world of punk, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, when I did the release show for that Weird Al tribute, that punk tribute album I did, you know, we did it in Highland Park, and that I'd say about 200 people showed up for that, which was a bit more. But it's like, you know, that Weird Al stuff, I almost kind of separate from everything else I've done, because that thing is a hobby. That's just like a little like hobby thing.
Very specific, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
So tell me about the transition from being in a band to doing stand-up.
So, you know, in Hawaii, I would started going to the Hawaiian International Film Festival every year it came in. And I started really I was playing in bands, but I was getting really interested in, you know, entertainment and what would it take to be an actor or a filmmaker. And I would go to the Q&As for, you know, I remember going to see the first American screening of Battle Royale, which was at the Hawaiian International Film Festival.
Wow.
I remember Bruce Campbell was in a ice skating comedy from France about it's a French movie. And they're making a movie about ice skating, but they bring in an American actor to play like a player that gets transferred. And that's played by Bruce Campbell, doing the most Bruce Campbell. And that's saying a lot. I remember he was there. So like a bunch of horror kids went out to see the screening of this French comedy, all in their Evil Dead and Army of Darkness shirts and stuff like that. And, But I remember just seeing him and being so, like, I thought he was so cool and so funny and so charming. And it really was another thing of I was like, I want to do that stuff. I want to be like Bruce Campbell. I want to be like Mel Brooks. It's that film festival was very eye-opening for me. And so when I decided to move like a year after high school, I was like, all right, I'm going to move to LA to try and, you know, become an actor. And I moved out here and it was so big, it's so scary. And I remember I didn't know what to do. So I tried out for the Groundlings and it wasn't what I thought it was going to be like. And it just, everything was a bit too overwhelming. So I just ended up getting a job at a record store in Venice Beach and then living down in San Pedro with a bunch of punk kids, where I just kind of played in bands and kind of went on tour, like as a roadie sometimes. And it just, and that was like a year of me going like, well, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to start this. And so I was like, maybe if I just stop thinking I'm going to be in a band and I just start doing stand-up, that's the transition.
Well, it's a lot easier to travel as a stand-up with just your body and nothing else.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody tagging along in the bus. Yeah,
for sure. And it's the best decision I ever made, because it, in the most roundabout way, I've gotten to achieve, even though stand-up wasn't necessarily the thing that I always wanted to do, it's, to quote, Dana Gould, it's the nuclear rod that powers everything else.
So it has opened doors to you as an actor, as a writer, as a performer.
Yeah, they're all linked. It's all part of the same thing, which is a creative output. And it doesn't mean, don't compartmentalize yourself, just let it flow wherever it's going to come out of.
Well, there is a chauvinism about the horror genre as well. You know, if you have some success within this field, as many of us have, you're also put into kind of a box, that horror box that is not particularly respected, and they don't think of you in any other way. And yet, I think it's a lot harder to make a good horror movie than it is to make a good drama. It has
definitely
to be good drama, and then you layer in the other elements of where it goes.
Yeah, that's precisely it. And, it's people – I always think about when there's that story that Edgar Wright talks about when they're talking to George Romero, and he's like, so what are you guys doing next? What's the next project? And they're like, it was after Shaun the Dead. They're like, oh, we're going to do a parody of like action cop movies called Hot Fuzz. And his response was like, oh, you're going to try and get out. And like, meaning you're going to try and get out of horror.
Escape. Freedom.
Yeah. But that's the crazy thing is Romero made so many great different types of movies. Everyone was like, oh, but you do that one thing.
That one thing. It was just the Living Dead thing, just horror, but just zombie horror. And he was probably trapped more than any of the other genre people that I knew by that chauvinism. He was restricted to just like, I didn't just do horror movies. I did Stephen King horror movies. With George Romero, he didn't just do horror movies. He did zombie movies. And he tried so hard to get out of it. And no one would let him. And which is why he never left Pittsburgh and kept doing everything independently. And it can be rough.
Yeah, like we were saying, it's hard to do a good genre movie in any genre, like horror specifically, because it has to be a good movie, and then there has to be other elements. So that's the fun thing about seeing Taika Waititi in all of the interviews he's doing for Jojo Rabbit, where he just keeps on saying, I'm glad this comedy is doing well, because comedy is one of the hardest things to pull off. Oh. And he talks about, like, it's like comedy acting is hard. Comedy directing and editing is tricky. But when you're doing a drama, all you're trying to do is make it as real as possible. And that's usually what's real is not that, I'm not saying it's boring, but I'm just saying it's just a facsimile.
Yeah. Well, you can get a good script, a good group of actors, a good score, and you can make a really good drama. But, you don't just have people working well. They have to work innovatively and surprisingly and create tension and its release. And it's such a combination when you're talking about working on something that affects you physically. Comedy and horror, we've talked about often on the show, how much they have in common, how much they shake hands, because they go for a visceral, physical response. And, nothing is more clear than we'll get into MST3K. We get into that. But tell me about your first stand-up gig.
Oh, I mean, there's the open mic would be my first, because I had done a little bit when I was in this crazy hardcore band that was like a straight edge, animal rights, vegan hardcore band when I was a kid.
Oh.
And, And everything was so, so heavy. And I was like 15 and I was like, I want to just be silly. And I, so I used to do, I used to read funny poems I would write to a guy playing bongos after our sets to kind of, you know, just, I was like, all right, tough guy town is done.
This is beatnik stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And because I'd gotten really into the Last Poets, which was a very great kind of Black Panther revolutionary stuff. And I kind of started making parodies of some of their stuff, and so I kind of had some of that behind me before I ended up doing stand up. But I remember I went to the Ha Ha Cafe in North Hollywood.
On Lancashire. Yeah.
On Lancashire. And I remember it went like pretty well, like up to a point I was like, oh, this is kind of, you know, it's just an open mic and it was early and there was other comics were laughing though. And then I made some joke, like I made an incest joke and it turned everyone against me. And like, I got like booed and told to leave. And
oh my, and
so that was my first, stand up experience for sure. It was terrible and great enough for me to, hesitantly do it for the last 18 years.
Were you ever opener on a terrible bill where you did not match at all?
Yes. I did Hornblowers, which was a space out in Ventura. And the headline act was a duo, which was a blind guy who was like, he was like a blind, I think, a Mexican guy, and then an Irish guy was his partner. And I say that because I mentioned, you know, their nationalities, because that's like what they use for a lot of their bits.
That was their shtick. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it was real broad and real, you know, I think they were billed as, you know, one of Jay Leno's favorite comedy acts. And just because a friend of mine couldn't middle, he had to cancel. So he's like, hey, my friend Jonah Ray can come up and do it. And I went up and it was, you know, I was just this 20 years old, I think, still 21 maybe. And I just was just, and then probably the worst I ever bombed though was I was at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, but it wasn't in Montreal. They have these shows that they'll do like 40 miles out of the town called, you know, Montreal satellite shows. And it was all these kind of affluent, you know, people that were not into what I was doing. And then I had this urge, this combativeness to just start doing the grossest stuff and the dumbest stuff I could. And I remember Alonzo Bowden, who's this incredible comic. He came up to me after my set. He's like, that's right, man. If they're not having your shit, you take them the fuck out.
Excellent advice.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, from doing like this, like all the stand-up stuff, it's like how I've, you know, you just end up meeting so many people and then kind of like fiddling away a career in different aspects.
Well, who were your comedy idols?
My comedy idols like are Albert Brooks and Mel Brooks. I love them.
I got to write for Mel Brooks. I wrote The Fly 2, and Mel was the producer, Brooks Films.
And that's right. Him and Stu Kornfeld.
Yes. And meeting with Mel and getting notes from him and having conversations. He's this very intelligent, erudite, educated man and funny as hell. But he'd be not at all the Mel Brooks you'd expect. And then suddenly, then you'd get the 2,000-year-old man, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's
an amazing experience.
I can't imagine that. It's like, that's like when Stu Kornfeld, you know, he went on to be producing partners with Ben Stiller.
Right.
At Red Hour. And they produced mine and Kumail Nanjiani's stand-up show on Comedy Central. Meltdown.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So when I got to meet Stu Kornfeld, I had decades of questions to ask him.
Yes.
About all the different stuff. Like, you know, I was like, because I knew, I always heard that it's like he was the reason, you know, he was the reason that, you know, David Lynch, you know, directed Elephant Man and that Cronenberg.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Stu Kornfeld was the, you know, Mel's like hipster on the bottom floor, you know, right. of just right. like, it's like, these are the guys that you should get. These are the cool directors that are doing interesting things. And it's, I hope that one day there's a book about him because he's such a weird legend.
Yeah. I hope that Mel writes an autobiography because he's such a literate and funny and smart guy.
You know, I just read last year, they put out a Funny Man, which was a biography on Mel. And I was excited. I was excited to read it, but because, you know, Mel doesn't really, he kind of keeps a lot of stuff quiet. You know, he has his go-to stories and bits and, and I read this and I was like midway through going, I think this guy hates Mel Brooks.
Wow. That's it. Well, one of the highest profile things that you did is a mashup of comedy and horror movies with MST3K. Tell me how that came around. I mean, to me, it's one of the only successful Kickstarter campaigns that has really worked out.
Yeah, I mean, we had at the time, it was the most successful Kickstarter for, you know, video project. I think Critical Role just knocked us off the throne. But I was, you know, that's the thing. When I was growing up, I loved Mystery Science Theater. And because it was this, it was a combination of the things I liked, you know, it was just old weird movies, you know, comedy, just, it just, you know, like there were sketches, there was all kinds of, you know, there were songs. It was, because I also loved Weird Al. So I loved, it was just this, there was all this different stuff. And it really was a, just, it hit every notch. And then I remember it, I was, you know, just had shirts, posters of it. And then I think about a year into doing stand-up, I had a meeting. I kind of got noticed and I had meetings with agents and managers and stuff like that. And they always do that thing. It's like, oh, what would your show be if you had a show idea? And I said, I'd probably just try and bring back Mystery Science Theater. And at that point, it had only been off the air for maybe 4 years.
Right.
So, so, you know, they were like, no, that's never going to happen. And so it's just, you know, it's just one of my favorite things. And to be able to have been able to get to do it is even, you know, crazier to me.
That's two seasons of it too.
Two seasons, 20 episodes. And it's so funny because when people were like, you know, it's when Netflix didn't pick up, for a third season, everyone's like, wow, what? Yeah. Like, it's like so upset. And it was the most zen I'd ever felt about something like this. Cause one, if you're doing this stuff long enough, you know, it's like, you know, like two seasons is more than you could ask for sometimes. And like, so when all was said and done, I was just like, wow. I hadn't felt that kind of gratitude yet in my life. It's something I try to do with everything and I'm terrible at it. I'm always upset or jealous of people. And,
it was the same thing with us. We did two seasons of Masters of Horror, mm-hmm. and it stopped after that. And people, again, like in your case, were so upset and, oh, isn't it terrible? Why you can't do it? And I said, hell, we did 26 episodes. I'm really, really proud of. And mm-hmm. I'd much rather drink that half full glass of look what we got to do than the half empty glass of, oh shit, we didn't get to do more. I mean, we stopped at a really good spot.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's best to not be bitter because it really, especially, I mean, I'm sure we've had enough friends that had a couple, you know, a couple years of just like misses and you see them start to become bitter. And then there's this not the stink of failure, but the stink of bitterness, the taste of it. And you kind of go, I don't want to this. Yeah. The guy's just complaining all the time because he feels he's been wronged or she says she can never get anything going and it's all everyone else's fault. Like it's, you got to be careful that you don't become that person. Yeah. Yeah. You have to be someone that's not that angry.
It happens a lot. And, you know, the entertainment business does not owe any of us anything.
No, anything we can get, we don't deserve. And we should be grateful for our masters.
Exactly. So tell me about that process. How did it really come together? Was Joel Hodgson involved? I imagine he had to give his blessing, right?
No, it was his baby. Again, you know, he got the rights back. He, you know, he... he got the money together with Shout Factory to get the rights back to Mr. Science Theater. And he is just kind of used, you know, we had met just through kind of these different things. I was on a podcast that he was a guest on, and then we ran into each other, and then we kind of just started emailing and becoming friends. And, you know, he had to give someone an award at some event. And so he asked if I wanted to help him write jokes for it. And so we kind of got along. Wow. In that style, you know, just, and I was just, and he was always kind of like, yeah, man, you know, I'm thinking about bringing it back, but you know, we'll see. And
that's a very Hawaiian attitude, even though he
yeah, there's a lot of, like, he always calls me, like, you know, me and my wife will do the same thing. She called me honorary Midwesterner. I think there's a lot of correlation between the attitudes of Midwesterners and Hawaiians. You know, we just kind of stay in contact, and he was always like, yeah, if we bring it back, would you want to be involved? I said, yes, I will do anything. I'll write on it. I will PA. I will, you know, anything you want. And then,
did you anticipate being asked to be the lead character?
No, of course. But I'd be lying if I didn't say in my head that I was like, should I just tell him I should be the guy? but he finally, after like a year and a half of talking about it, he's like, you know, I just realized you should be the guy. Cause he had seen enough of the stuff I had, you know, done performing wise in comedy. And I had, you know, I'd done a couple like web series, and I had the show Hidden America, and he kind of just saw, he's like, yeah, I think you should just be the guy. And I remember when he said that, I was like, what guy? Which guy? He's like, the Mike. Yeah, yeah. The only guy. And so it, you know, then we did the Kickstarter, and I was like, oh, I don't know if that's going to work. And it worked really well. And then, you know, he's like, who do you want to be the voices of the robots? And I said, I can only think of these two guys that are just perfect for it, which were my stand-up buddies, Hampton Yunt doing Crow and Baron Vaughn, right. Who's an incredible actor in his own right for Servo. And yeah, it just kind of all really happened. And it was all, you know, it seemed like it took forever. And then it was, once production started, it was breakneck fast. And I was scared the whole time, because I was the face of this very beloved thing that I would maybe be hesitant about.
Right.
And I would be ready to hate me. If it wasn't me, I probably would have hated whoever got it.
Well, tell me about the process of the show. I know a lot of it was ad-lib, but it had to have been planned as well. You had to have gone over the movies. But how did the Kickstarter thing happen, and how did that meld into the Netflix deal and become a reality?
Well, when Joel, he said, we're going to Kickstart it, he met some guy, Ivan Asquith, who was a producer on the show. He worked at you know, Kickstarter, and he's like, we're going to do this whole thing. And I'd never understood any of that stuff. And I still have a hard time asking for money for anything, you know, just, it's, you know. And so we launched it, and and then, you know, they weren't announcing me right away. And then I was scared that it was good. If like, once I'm announced, it's going to drop down. And then, and it started like making a ton of money, and I was like, oh no, it's like, is it way more popular than Joel thought? And then he's going to quickly recast me with Seth Rogen or something, you know? And it just kind of kept on growing, and then we did it. And then there was a kind of a bidding war between Netflix and CISO, which was the NBC digital platform that I was doing my other show, Hidden America. Right. Which is a travel parody. And, you know, it's, and there was just like this, and I remember the whole time I was like, please Netflix. I wanted Netflix so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, it happened. And because we made so much money off of it, that's why we were able to do 14 episodes, which is a long season for Netflix.
Yeah, for sure. Now, what was the process of choosing the films? I assume they were all public domain movies.
No, none of the movies have really ever been public domain since I think about the second season. They get the rights.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you're not, I think when they moved to cable, I think it just, they had a little extra money to get the rights and stuff.
But
like
it was
that.
No longer a local show. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah. And all of these things are, you know, people. That's why it's you know, it's a dinky looking show for the most part, endearingly so. But it does cost a lot of money because you have to get the rights to these movies to show. And, you know, it's usually one of those things where you go to one distributor that has a good library and you kind of just try and do a deal with that distributor. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of the stuff where it's, you know, it's like, they're like, ooh, they have that movie. And they're like, yes, mm-hmm. but to get that movie, you're going to have to maybe use one of these movies too. And then, and you know, and but Joel is very, very meticulous with, you know, we had a lot of American International pictures, and I remember and I remember there was a deal, there was some deal where it's like, we could use Corman movies, but we couldn't make jokes about him or his wife. That was the rule, and everyone was like, why would we?
And he probably did not impose that rule himself.
No, exactly. And then I remember we did an Al Adamson movie. We did his most family friendly fare, Carnival Magic.
Oh, God.
And there was a big discussion of do we make references to like what happened to this guy? And everyone's right. Like, no, oh, the movie's sad enough.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that there's a new collection of Adamson, 30 of his movies all together with the documentary about his life and the whole murder case and being buried under concrete and all of that. But that's another show.
That's the next, like, from the makers of Tiger King comes the Al Adamson documentary.
That Tiger King is phenomenal.
I'm savoring it. We're not blazing through it. We're watching like an episode every couple days. I love it.
I couldn't stop. Great.
Yeah. My friend had a great perspective on it. He says, with everybody like loving, you know, the people in Tiger King, he's like, this is why Jody Hill and Danny McBride are successful, is because they were able to tap in to this specific kind of Southerner.
Wow. That's for sure. Wow. Yeah. So tell me about your life as a podcaster and nerdist and being a part of that nerd culture too, because there's so many different sides to that cube that is Jonah Ray, you know?
Yeah. You know, I was doing stand up and making videos and then Chris Hardwick was starting a show called Web Soup with some other people that he was going to be the host of it. And so he recommended me to be, a writer on the show and who would direct sketches. And so I had to interview for it and get the job from Brad Stevens and Boyd Vico, who were working on The Soup. And so, you know, I came on to that show, just, you know, directing sketches, writing jokes. And then when we were doing that, we ended up doing a pilot for some other e-show. And it was like looking like it was going to go, and then it didn't. And then Chris just decided he wanted to start a podcast. And he was like, do you want to be in this podcast with me? We'll call it The Nerdist after my website. And I was like, yeah, sure. What's a podcast? And so, you know, we started it and we had, you know, Matt Meyer, of course, was a part of it. And I, you know, I never had any intention of, I never considered myself a part of nerd culture. I just, you know, nerd culture, I think was still, and I was working, of course, at, you know, G4, which was a, you know, tech right. and nerd
network. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's only really because I was doing stuff there already, mainly because a guy who was doing their sketches saw me do stand up and cast me in something. And then we started writing stuff. And the idea of making it, like, it's like, I was pursuing comedy. Right. And so, like, when we started doing The Nerdist, it's like, and it blew up so fast and so big. And I kind of just, you know, I never had any intention of being like an interview person or like a host of any sort. I just wanted to make stuff. I never wanted to really be myself. If I was going to be myself, it was going to be a, you know, a version of it. And so I just kind of was along for this ride and was definitely a, you know, a part, like considered like a nerd comic all of a sudden, like all these things that I was just like, I was like, but I'm just in comedy. I don't understand. And
But your tech knowledge must have expanded during that period.
just from seeing, you know, people wealthier than I buying stuff.
I want to jump back just for 1 second to MST3K, because I know you were on the Movies That Made Me podcast. I've always known how Joe feels about that show. He felt that it disrespected the movies, but it's obviously done with so much affection. And I'd just love to talk to you about that when he did kind of spank you a little bit.
He did. So Josh Olson, asked me to, he's like, oh, would you want to do the Movies That Made Me podcast? And I was like, oh yes, please. I love Joe Dante. This would be so cool. I get to the office, I sit down, and then right before Joe Dante walks in, Joe despises Mystery Science Theater 3000.
But welcome to our show.
Yeah, and I was like, right on. And then he comes in, and Joe is so aloof and so cool, and he just sits down and crosses his legs, and he's just kind of his hair. It's just kind of perfectly coiffed, I would always put like you, Joe, and David Lynch in the Mount Rushmore of hair directors. but it's like, so you got this guy right in front of you who you just love, and you love his movies, and you think he's great, and he's done so much for so many people, and he's got this, he's tied into the history of a lot of stuff I like, and he just kind of, and the thing is, it's like, and I say this with, knowing our own, kind, but like, he's like a hipster. So he starts giving me the hipster treatment of like,
I have never thought of Joe as a hipster or heard him referred to as a hipster. This will be a big surprise to him, I'm sure.
I think just like, I think not of like the hipster we know of, like now, right. But like, I think
not he's a Melrose hipster, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But just like, it's just like, he was very dismissive of it, of Mystery Science Theater. And then he started taking me to task for stuff that had nothing to do with me. Like, it was like, it's like, you guys don't use good prints of the movies. You edit them down. There's like the commercial breaks and makes everything. And then you have to put those dumb sketches in the middle of it. You're talking over it. And you're never getting good prints. Everything looks so bad. Some of those movies were good. And I wanted to so much be just like, it's like, hey man, this is my first day. I just started working here. That's from a different time. And then, I think he also brought up like, This Island Earth, which was, he was just very upset that that was done for the movie all before.
That they did.
Yeah. Which is one of my favorites. I saw it in the theater. And actually two of my stand-up records are named after lines from that Mystery Science Theater movie.
That's amazing.
And that was like years before what is even a possibility to be involved in it. But I digress. So he's like kind of going on. And then I kind of realized I'm just telling him it's like, I love these movies. I admire these movies. I grew up watching these movies. But it doesn't mean that I can't, it's like when you have a friend, you make fun of your friend.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you love them any less, and so
it's sign of affection to tease, right?
I think so. I think so for sure. And, we don't, we call them cheesy. We don't say, we don't say, it's like, oh, these are shitty movies, we do our best to never make any jokes about like, it's like, oh, well, that was dumb or that sucked or what was that? We start to kind of layer in another aspect of what the movie's already providing. And so I kind of said it's much like sampling in hip hop or collage work where you're kind of taking all these different elements of maybe you're singing a song over something, or you're referencing another movie that this movie, had something in common with, and you're bringing in all these different ideas with words over a screen to make this pastiche of a new form. So it's just it's a remixed, if you're going to say like, is hip hop, making fun of the songs they're sampling? No, they're reutilizing old art to make a collage of something else. And then he was like, all right, yeah, pastiche.
Fair enough, and not too much of a rationalization.
I do believe that, though. I think it's, you know,
no,
it's
course.
Just kind of same. It's a, you know, it's part. It's just a new way of parody. I think it's just a new a different form of parody.
Yeah, it's not dismissing it. If anything, it's celebrating it.
There's a lot of movies that people now know about because, you know, there's a whole cultural around Manos, Hands of Fate,
yes.
Which is, you know, not, I'll say out of all the movies they've done, that one's just not good.
But do you there's have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite, like of the movie itself or the episode?
Of the movies that you did. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, I found the Italian movie, The Christmas That Almost Wasn't. I thought that was such a fascinating movie. Just the idea that Santa Claus's workshop, the land that he got sold, and so he's being evicted by a guy that hates the sound of children laughing. And then there's this amazing – so he gets a lawyer to help him out to try and get the – it's just a very fascinating story. And also there's this amazing weird element that was – it's almost – like, it's like, oh, yeah, I never even thought of this before, where Santa Claus, it's like, he's like, I love children. I just love how they're so peaceful and their eyes are closed and they just look so, they're very cute and they're just so quiet. And the guy, his friend Whipple, who's obsessed with them, goes, wait, have you never seen a kid awake? and so it's like Santa Claus has to come to terms with like, kids being loud and screaming as he becomes a mall Santa Claus. It's just a fascinating and tons of great ideas. But I think also as far as some of the other ones we've done, my favorite is probably Land That Time Forgot. I think that's like that's such a big swing and it's a great, you know, McClure movie.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And Time Travelers. I think Time Travelers is a fantastic movie.
I do too. And that had a Forrest Ackerman cameo in it too.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's just like just the look of Time Travelers and all the practical magic that was done for the effects, which were all just like magic tricks.
Right. They brought in a magician to do magic tricks instead of visual effects. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But those are probably two of my favorites. Yeah.
Well, let's before we wrap it up, first of all, I want to say that we are doing this remotely because of the coronavirus. We are in different rooms and doing this over online. So if there are any technical issues, thank you for bearing with us for doing that. But I also want to get into your acting career a little bit, particularly because you've got a brand new movie, Pucca, coming out on Hulu by our friend Alejandro Brugues.
Yes, yes. Alejandro Brugues, who hates when I pronounce his name because I always just call him Burgess and he can't stand it. There's a sequel to Pucca from the Into the Dark series that they do that Nacho Vigalondo was the director of the first one. And Alejandro directed this one. It was written by Ryan Coppler, who is writing partners with Felicia Day, who is one of the producers on it and an actor in it. And I play her husband. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of fun. That was like one of the best experiences I had acting yet. You know, I got to do, and I love being in horror movies. And I love, cause I got to be in Victor Crowley. For Adam Green, and who was also in Bands, another director in Bands.
There you go.
And you know that was like I shot that in the middle of making my show Hidden America, and also shooting Mystery Science Theater 3000. Wow. And so I had to like leave set and go out into the desert and shoot all night. We had one night to shoot the whole cold open of that thing, right? I get killed by, you know, Victor Crowley and. And so it's like, and that was a dream come true to just be killed in a horror movie, especially in a franchise, which is,
mind. Yeah.
Oh, please. I tell all my friends, I tell all my friends that make movies. I was like, I've never really wanted to, I never had the desire to be like the star of anything. I've been the lead in a lot of stuff I've made. But I really like my favorite actors are always the character actors, the side guys. And so just to just to be able to do that as much as possible, it would make me so happy to have a career like that.
Kill me, please.
And it also, keeps the health insurance going. But when I auditioned, I had to send in a tape for the Puka thing, and I wasn't sure who was involved. And the more I heard about, the more I got excited. I was, that was a Blumhouse production, and I was going to play Felicia's husband, and you got, Malcolm Barrett from Timeless and stuff like that. And I get
one of my favorite people. I mean, he's such a talented guy and such a really wonderful human being too.
He really is. You got to work with him on the Nightmare Cinema, which his segment of that is so great. Well, that's such a fantastic, that's a fantastic film. Really good job on that.
Thank you.
It's been kind of awkward for me this whole time, answering questions from you when you have such an amazing. If you ever want to have an episode where someone just talks to you and asks you questions,
I'll go on your show.
Alejandro was so great and so visual and was doing so much with such a short amount of time, and just was so buoyant on set the whole time. It really kind of trickles down from the director. It's like people, if the director is kind of stressed or something like that, everyone's going to start to get a little stressed, or if the star is kind of problematic, they'll stress out the director, and then the producers, everybody on set was so funny and so sweet and really just wanted to do things, right. And they didn't have enough money for me to have a stunt double. So I ended up having to do a bunch of my stunts myself.
Of course they didn't.
Yeah. And it's, it's funny. It's one of those things where you'd be fine falling over a desk, right? Tripping over and falling over. I was like, yeah, I loved physical comedy growing up. So I would always do pratfalls and stuff like that. But then you forget that it's not a pratfall. You have to fall 8 or 9 or 10 times.
Yes, from different angles and different takes.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, my body was really wrecked after a couple of these days. But it was so fun. And just to, ask Alejandro about Juan of the Dead and making a movie in Cuba. And then we become friends, and we're like, we're now trying to work on, more ideas to do stuff together in the future. I told him, I was like, I'll be your Bruce Campbell to my Sam Raimi.
That's it. So he'll figure out ways to torture you over and over and over again, like Sam does.
He was so verbally abusive on set, but with such a smile. But that was the best experience, because I got to, I got to just be, I was like fourth on the call list, and I got to do all these different types of scenes, and I got to, I got to run. I got to get hit and scratched. I got to have a funny moment with the girl who plays my kid. But it also fourth on the call list. It's like, I'm there all the time having a good time, and there's not a lot of pressure on me. And it was just the time of my life.
How great. Musician, stand up, writer, actor, performer. What have you not done that you really want to do? Do you want to direct a feature? Do you want to,
That's the next thing I want to try and, I wrote a script. I sold a script to BBC in England last year. Wow. Which would be just a workplace comedy set at a record store.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
I came from a Tower Records background myself. I was night manager. Yeah.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. So it's a little I'm a little worried because, High Fidelity has come out since I've, started the process, but that's just going to happen sometimes. And that is kind of in my head, the two things, I would love to, because I've done a lot of comedy and sketch style shows. I would love to do a more narrative comedy show, but then also at the same time, I'm trying to figure out how to adapt a graphic novel about herpes that I really want to make into a movie. And because I've been directing lots of music videos and stuff like that, and I want to try, because I just kind of want to do it all. I want to be Mel Brooks in High Anxiety, where he just did everything, and I want to be Albert Brooks in everything he's made as well.
So great. Jonah Ray, thank you so much for joining us on this. This was really a blast. I'm so glad to have met you.
Thanks, Mick.
Last month in Florida, and I look forward to everything you do.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And a big fan. I know I said it before, but it's
there. Oh, it goes two ways. All right. Thanks.
Take awesome. Care. See you. You too.
If you have any comments or questions for the show, please contact us at Mick Garris PM on Twitter or Instagram, or at the Mick Garris and the Postmortem podcast page on Facebook. And if you're enjoying the show, we'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. Also, if you're interested, my latest book, These Evil Things We Do, the Mick Garris Collection, is available in paperback and Kindle ebook at Amazon.com. And my first short story collection, A Life in the Cinema, read by Miguel Ferrer, Matt Frewer, Stephen Weber, Joe R. Lansdale, and myself, is available now on audible.com.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.